Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I'm an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as always, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Hey there! Well, today, Chris, I thought we would talk about something that happened recently in the news, especially at the time that we're recording this, since it is currently mid-October-ish.
2012.
And earlier this week, as of the time we're recording this, a fellow named Felix Baumgartner did something pretty phenomenal.
Yes.
He fell.
Yeah. Nice.
He fell a lot.
Yeah.
He fell more than any man has ever fallen before.
Right. In space, no one can hear you fall.
Yeah, that's true.
As a matter of fact, you know, you said that it's been in the news. I think this is going to captivate people's attention for a long, long time. Because yeah. I don't know that anybody is ready to better this brand new record he set.
And this record was set more than, 40 years after the last one.
Yeah.
So it's been a while. What we're talking about is the Red Bull Stratos jump.
Yes.
So sponsored by Red Bull was this crazy attempt to break some world records. And many world records were broken, actually three. Three mm-hmm. out of the four that they were aiming for,
mm-hmm.
They broke. If you're curious about the one they did not break, it was for longest free fall. And I think they were going by longest as in time. Really, mm-hmm. they were looking at the time. It's kind of interesting because according to what they were going by, the person who had the record for the highest jump previously, which was an Air Force, United States Air Force colonel named Joseph Kittinger.
Mm-hmm. And, I heard his name pronounced Kittinger on the news report that I
okay.
saw. I don't know that that's...
Kittinger.
I don't know.
At any rate, he did several jumps for the Air Force to kind of test what this, how could a human survive in a high altitude jump?
Mm-hmm.
And on one of those jumps, he fell for 4 minutes and 36 seconds before deploying his main chute. However, he did use a drogue chute, which is a smaller chute, not meant to slow you to the safe speed, but rather to help guide your descent, because we'll get into why that's important. But he had that deployed in his jump. However, if you're really going to be a stickler, then 2 years later, that was in 1960, 2 years later, so 1962, Eugene Andreev jumped from an altitude of around 83,523 feet, which is around 25,457 meters, over Russia. And he fell for 80,380 feet, or 24,500 meters, before deploying his chute without using a drogue chute. So depending on the way you look at it, his is the longest free fall because there was no drogue chute deployed. Anyway, Baumgartner's fall did not last that long before deploying his chute. It was 4 minutes 22 seconds, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So he did not break that record. However, other records he definitely did break. And it was a remarkable achievement on multiple fronts. I mean, just human endurance to be able to handle that kind of battering about you get in a jump of that size, as well as the technical achievements that we made in order to make this possible. So we wanted to talk a little bit about why this is such a challenging thing to take on,
mm-hmm.
and the kind of stuff he used to achieve it. And of course, this was a huge effort. I mean, this is not one guy going up in a plane and jumping out and deploying a chute. I mean, there was a huge team in place to bring this about.
Mm-hmm. And of course, as Jonathan has already mentioned, this is not an effort that was backed by a government. This was completely private.
Yep.
Which you know, in some respects makes things easier. And yes, they didn't use any kind of spacecraft. They did have a pressurized capsule,
yep.
that was lifted into place by a very, very tall balloon.
Yeah, actually, the balloon got less tall as it got further up in the atmosphere because of the changes in pressure. In fact, that's probably the first thing we should talk about is the air pressure and why there were so many things needing to be in place in order for him to have a successful jump. Air pressure changes at elevations, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, it makes sense. You figure when you think about the Earth and you think about the atmosphere around the Earth, well, if you're on the surface of the Earth, you've got more atmosphere above you pressing down on you than you would if you were quite a bit of the ways up.
Mm-hmm.
And so at sea level, you have one atmosphere of pressure. Now, if you're wondering, well, what does that mean in terms of other units? That's just under 15 pounds per square inch, and you're welcome, Europe, that I did this, 1.03 kilograms per square centimeter. But one atmosphere is a much easier way of saying that. So that's at sea level, and that's the average.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so even at sea level, that number changes somewhat, but the average is that number.
Okay.
Now, at 35,000 feet, which is around where a lot of commercial air flights might be, somewhere around in that area,
yeah.
Which is 10,700 meters. See, I did this all the way around. It's about 3.5 pounds per square inch. So
mm-hmm.
remember, at sea level, 15 pounds, 35,000 feet, around 3.5 pounds. That, by the way, is 0.25 kilograms per square centimeter. or 0.24 atmospheres. At around 62,000 feet or 19,000 meters, the pressure has reached a point where it's so so much less than what we experience that we can have some pretty serious health risks.
Mm-hmm.
We've evolved on this planet to be able to survive in the conditions of our environment. So, we're used to having this certain amount of air pressure. Beyond that, we don't do so well. And if the pressure's too light, then our blood can actually start to have gas form within it, and then will expand, which is called ebullism,
mm-hmm.
and it is not a good thing to have happen to you. So that's why pressure is a big deal. And of course, we haven't even reached the height of the where the jump was, because the goal for this jump was to jump out at around 120,000 feet. In actuality, he got all the way up to around 128,100 feet, which is 39,045 meters, which is just over 24 miles up, or 39 kilometers for those of you who wanted to, you know, not divide that number of meters there. It took about 2 hours for him to get there. But at that elevation, air pressure is less than 1 pound per square inch, or less than 0.07 kilograms per square centimeter, or 0.07 atmospheres. So you're talking about very little air pressure at all. And because of that, both the capsule he was in and, of course, the suit he was wearing needed to be pressurized so that he would not have any major health risks when he jumped out, or just mm-hmm. from the ascent. So the capsule was pressurized first, and it was done that way so that he would not have to pressurize his suit from the ground as they started to ascend. By having it in the capsule, it took some of that energy that was needed off the actual suit, which is good. You want to preserve that as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Once they reached the float height, which is where the balloon was not going to rise any higher, it had mm-hmm. gone as high as it was going to go, then that was when it was time to open up the door and start off the jump. Well, that's where they had to depressurize the cabin and pressurize the suit. Actually, mm-hmm. pressurize the suit first, obviously.
Right, yes.
Very important step. But then depressurize the cabin so that they could open up the door. You can't open that door otherwise. There's too much pressure on the inside. It's just like if you're in an airplane and you have the emergency exit. The emergency exit, if you are at altitude, it's going to have so much tremendous amount of pressure on the inside because the airplane itself is pressurized while the outside is not. You can't open that door. Mm-hmm. You're just not physically strong enough. Same thing here. Once it was depressurized, he could open up the door. His suit had been pressurized. And that was what gave him that safety of, at least from the environment. I mean, there's so many other things you have to worry about, but as far as air pressure goes, that was how they took care of that. And of course, all the different parts of his suit were sealed so that there wouldn't be any leaks. Like the gloves had these rotating locks on them so that you could have them airtight with the suit as well as the helmet. This was really important because Kittinger had a jump where he had a hole in one of his gloves. And apparently the glove ended up for the pressure, it ended up sticking to his hand enough so that it wasn't a huge problem. And he did not report this to ground control because of fear that they would cancel the jump. But by the time he landed, there was a problem. His hand started to swell and apparently swelled to about twice the size of normal, due to the changes in pressure and so that's something you don't want to have happen
mm-hmm.
if you can avoid it.
That's true. Yeah, the suit was actually made by a company from Massachusetts, David Clark.
Yep.
They
made suits for the Gemini missions. As well as space shuttle missions, Gemini missions.
If that sounds like an internal joke, it sort of is.
You got to listen to some of our previous space podcasts.
We did a series on the Gemini missions a few years ago, and one of the astronauts from that time kept pronouncing it Gemini, and Jonathan's blood pressure just kept rising every time he said it.
Gemini cricket.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was. Same company that did that.
They've made all kinds of suits for aeronautics and space for decades now.
Yep.
So, you know, they're a well-known, well-respected firm to have done that. And obviously, since the jump was successful, no spoilers intended, but, you know, well, it's nice to know.
I was about to say, you can't really spoil something that already happened.
Well, no, if somebody's like just now hearing about this.
Yeah, well.
Then you have been hiding in a hole.
You can actually watch this live when it happened. And from about an hour into it, I turned it on after it had been on for an hour because the mm-hmm. ascent took just over 2 hours mm-hmm. to get to the right altitude. So
Jonathan told me about how he felt when Bumgardner opened the capsule door and started to step out.
Yeah.
They call him Fearless Felix. That's the nickname he has.
Yeah. Sheer terror was what was going through me.
Yeah.
Seeing his – yeah, well, we'll get into it. But to go back to the suit, it also could withstand temperatures as low as minus 90 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 68 Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
Or over 100 degrees Fahrenheit or 37.8 degrees Celsius. So also very important because, of course, at that elevation, you were also talking about very, very cold temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, there were parts of his fall that were colder than others. It was interesting because it actually warmed up a little bit from – I forget
friction?
What – Not friction. I'm just talking about the ambient temperature.
Oh, sorry.
Actually warmed up. Like, there was a point in the atmosphere. Yeah, no, I was watching, and they talked about it, too. They said, well, you know, you're closer to the sun. I'm like, really? You're not that much closer. The sun's 93 million miles away. I think a few feet isn't a huge difference.
No,
but,
I imagine not.
But it was interesting. You could watch, and the temperature gauge was going up. It went really low and then started creeping up again, just slightly. Not like – it wasn't like skyrocketing. But at the height where he was jumping, the temperature was around minus 10 Fahrenheit, which is minus 23 Celsius. So
– I blame cows.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Methane production? Is that what you're talking about? Okay. I was trying to see where you're going there.
Note, not based on scientific fact, mostly because I just wanted to say cows.
Gotcha. So, so the suit had to be able to withstand these cold temperatures as well. And mm-hmm. his suit also had it looked a lot like the spacesuits you would see, in any NASA presentation or if you've watched any of those launches. It looks a lot like those.
Actually, it also looked a little bit, just from appearances sake, sort of like the stuff that race car drivers wear.
Yeah.
Probably mostly because the names and the decals and things.
Right. Yeah.
So
it also had
sponsors.
It also had a sun visor that Felix could put down or up if he needed to. And the visor itself was heated in order to have it avoid icing issues. You know, obviously, if you're going through super cold temperatures and you've, we give off a lot of water vapor, as it turns out.
Mm-hmm.
And there could be a lot of icing problems both on the inside and outside of a suit. And in fact, that was one of the issues that almost seemed to be a big problem during the ascent because mm-hmm. it looked like, according to Felix, that the faceplate was not heating properly.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think the first time I heard about that was when he was around 80,000 feet or so and still rising, obviously still climbing. And then you hear the people on who are speaking during the whole ascent, the people who are relaying information to the audience mm-hmm. saying, everyone here is trying to find out what options we have. And I'm like, wow, what options do you have? And the option, the biggest, like, last ditch option thing, in mm-hmm. order to get him back to Earth safely, you ditch the jump.
Right.
But the capsule itself was connected to the balloon and could disconnect and had its own parachute.
Yeah.
So the worst case scenario action would be to cut the tie to the balloon
mm-hmm.
to deploy the parachute on the capsule and have the capsule come down to Earth. Now, that was not ideal. First of all, you're aborting the jump, so that's not ideal. But
right.
also, it would have been a bit of a rough landing. Now, the capsule itself had crash sections built into it, crash mm-hmm. pads, to absorb some of that impact if it were to to have to land. Now, and of course they did detach the capsule at the end of the jump anyway, because they wanted to retrieve the capsule. But, it definitely would not have been a soft landing.
Yeah.
It would have been a little rough. And it's interesting because the inside of the capsule, again, looked very much like the Gemini capsules. it was a tiny little thing, really. The capsule was 6 feet tall, or 1.8 meters, mm-hmm. and it weighed 2,900 pounds, or 1,315 kilograms. And, you take a look at this and you're like, wow, this looks like it would fit, you know, in a special casing on the top of a rocket. It really did look like some of those early NASA spacecraft.
Mm-hmm. True enough. So, should we talk about the jump?
Sure. There are other things. Actually, before we talk about the jump, I want to talk about the balloon.
Oh, the balloon.
Okay. I want to talk about the balloon because the balloon is crazy. Yes. So
it has its own story. Actually, five or so of them.
Well, the weird thing I thought, the strangest thing to me about the balloon was how incredibly thin that material was.
Yeah.
So it was made out of polyethylene plastic film.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 0.0008 inches thick.
That's pretty thin.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty thin. Or 0.0002 or 0.0002 centimeters thick. There we go.
All right.
I've got to get that number right. But yeah, super, super thin. They called it a 40-acre dry cleaner bag. Because it was essentially made out of very similar stuff. Now, if you're thinking, like, how could that possibly bear the weight of this capsule, which, you know, weighs quite a bit, the way they did it was they used this load tape that mm-hmm. was connected to the balloon, and the load tape was actually what bore the load of the capsule.
Right.
The tape also had in it a special reflective material so that the balloon would show up on radar.
Mm-hmm.
Very important for any aircraft in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Although, of course, the mission was working along with air traffic controllers to make sure there wouldn't be any problems on that. Because, you know, you can't really direct where a balloon's going to go.
Right, right.
You are at the mercy of the winds.
Mm-hmm. Although this was over the desert in the southwestern United States.
Yeah, it was near.
So there weren't a lot of populated areas.
Right, near Roswell, New Mexico. So it was really just the military and aliens
right.
that were there.
Exactly.
By the way, I'm totally joking. The whole Roswell alien thing is absolutely ludicrous. But anyway, and that balloon was created by ATA Aerospace.
Mm-hmm.
And here's some stats on the balloon. Some for people who are curious about how big this was. Yeah. So uninflated, it was 592.41 feet long, or 180.6 meters. Now, at the height, once it was inflated, which takes about an hour, to inflate this balloon with helium. They used helium because it's non-flammable. Very important.
If you've been wondering why there's a helium shortage.
Yeah. Yeah, talk about...
Because that's a big balloon
to fill up with helium. Yeah, the LHC might have a few things to say to Felix.
Have you explained to your kid why she can't get a Dora balloon? Yeah. Now you know. Blame it on Felix.
So, just get that Dora balloon filled with hydrogen. I can't imagine anything bad happening from that.
Take it to a birthday party.
Don't do that. Hydrogen is highly flammable. That's why they went with helium.
Blow out the candles.
The height of the balloon, once it was fully inflated at takeoff, was about 550 feet, or 167.6 meters. And once it reached its altitude, the height was more like 334.82 feet, or 102.1 meters. Because, again, as it got higher up in the atmosphere, as that atmospheric pressure decreased, the balloon started to the height began to decrease, but its diameter increased. It began to round out quite a bit. Because when you first looked at it, it looked like a teardrop.
Yeah, it was kind of tall and skinny, really, compared to what we think of when we do think of birthday party balloons. You know, I mean, those are teardrop shaped too, but not this is a lot longer than that.
Right. So once so it got up to the –
got
the,
mushroomier.
Yeah. It definitely rounded out as it got higher up. And uninflated, it weighed a svelte 3,708 pounds or 1,682 kilograms.
You just wanted to say svelte.
I did. And yeah, and it also had a vent so that it could vent off helium. Now, this is also really important.
You know what bugs me?
No,
those other balloons, I think they're...
No, it didn't. It didn't vent anger. It vented helium. Yeah. Now the reason for the vent is very important because the helium was expanding as the balloon was climbing. Right. So, there does come a point where there's a possibility that that expansion could damage the balloon itself and tear the balloon. So the balloon needed to have a way of venting out excess helium in order to avoid that. And in fact, they did vent helium at least once or twice, especially once they passed that 120,000 feet mark, because that, again, was their goal, and they went right by it and kept on going. There was a point where there was some concern about making sure that the balloon and capsule maintained integrity.
Yeah.
Because it was starting to go beyond what they had planned. So
as long as they didn't run into any wire coat hangers, because that seems to be the downfall of most dry cleaner bags.
Right. Yeah. That's exactly the problem.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
They also had some other pretty cool equipment involved in this. They had 9 high definition cameras that were mounted on both the suit and on and inside the capsule. So they had cameras mounted on these arms pointed back at the capsule, so you could get these great views of the capsule as it was going up. Also, as the door opened, which that's the part where I was terrified, and I'll talk about that in a second. But there were also cameras on the suit, so they could capture footage during the actual jump.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, beyond that, they had a helicopter that was using a camera mounted on a stabilization gyroscope to track Felix's movements. Mm-hmm. And they had ground cameras on these huge trucks with these enormous bases that were motorized so they could track the progress of the balloon. And it's phenomenal to me because you think that's a balloon that is more or less 24 miles up in the air.
Yeah.
So to have a camera that can capture something that's that far away is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
You know, you think about that for a second. You're like, well, yeah, I've got a digital zoom on my camera.
Yeah.
It goes up to 1.7. And well, this camera can capture something that's 24 miles away.
Well, tracking the balloon was a whole lot easier than tracking Felix after he stepped out of the capsule.
Right. He's much, first of all, he doesn't have all that reflective. He's smaller. Although not that much smaller. It's a 6 foot tall capsule.
He was also moving a whole lot faster.
Yes, yes. Cause he was going downwards.
Mm-hmm.
That was definitely, I mean, the footage that they captured was pretty phenomenal. And especially when you sit there and think about the challenges involved. And beyond that, not just capturing the footage, but transmitting the footage, getting that live feed from the capsule, you're thinking, wow, they had to dedicate a lot of bandwidth, in order to get that information from the capsule to the ground and stream it out live. And in fact, they had three dedicated video downlinks with built-in redundancy to get that information down to the ground. Mm-hmm. And then they had a fiber optic network on the ground to process that information. And they had live switching so they could switch, different cameras at different times to give the best angle or the best camera experience at any given moment.
Yeah.
Which was pretty, it was clearly something that the whole media side of it was, there was a lot of thought put toward it, which
well,
is,
sure.
That's
the age we're living in.
Yeah. So, getting to the actual jump, once they got to the point where, they had reached the right altitude, they had to go through a very long checklist to make sure that everything was prepared before the jump. And that involved pressurizing the suit, disconnecting the suit from the capsule because mm-hmm. the capsule had its own oxygen supply. Cause again, at that elevation, the atmosphere is so thin that we would not be able to breathe up there. So, the capsule had its own oxygen supply and then, the suit did as well. So you had to detach the suit from the capsule cause clearly you can't jump if you're still got all these hoses connected.
Well, you can, but it's not recommended.
No, it would not go well. So there was that. There was the whole depressurization, opening up the door, moving the chair around quite a bit. The chair inside the capsule could move forward and backward a little so that he could reach various controls.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the point where he had to move the chair back. He had depressurized the capsule, pressurized the suit. The door had opened. And then they used an exterior camera to capture the moment where he moves, he's lifted his feet up so they're above the threshold of the little capsule door.
Mm-hmm.
And then he moves the chair forward, which means his feet come out of the doorway and over nothing. And that's where I freaked out. At that point, he had to stand on a platform that was about the size of an average skateboard.
Yeah, looked like it.
Yeah, and there he is in a spacesuit, standing mm-hmm. on a skateboard-sized platform, holding on to these rails that are on either side of the capsule door.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And once he had the go-ahead, he let go and started falling. And I don't think I breathed until until he stopped spinning. So here's one of the issues about jumping at that height. So again, atmosphere is really thin, mm-hmm. right? You don't immediately start to slow down. In fact, the atmosphere is so thin that you will go faster than you would if you jumped from, any other height. Like, you don't have anything pushing against you or not as much pushing against you because there is atmosphere out there. It's just not mm-hmm. as much. It's in the stratosphere at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. And in case you're wondering, I happened to catch a news report in which, they had asked him, and Felix said that he didn't look down. He was looking straight out, which at that altitude, I'm not sure how you could avoid it because the Earth as you could see
the curvature the whole, of the earth.
The curvature of the earth, and you're going, okay, that's sort of down.
That's something else that's kind of interesting, is that the curvature, you can see it at that altitude, mm-hmm. but if you look at the footage from the jump, mm-hmm. the curvature is incredibly evident. Like it's obvious. The reason it's obvious is because of the camera lens.
Yeah.
It's a wide angle camera lens. So it artificially has bent the edges. So it looks like the curvature is much more, it looks
pronounced.
Like it's much further up than it really was. But in reality that you could, from what I've been told, you can see the curvature at that altitude. It's just not as dramatic as what it appeared as on the live stream. So mm-hmm. just wanted to point that out.
Yeah. But at that altitude, he moved very quickly into a very fast speed, 32 feet per second per second, or 9.754 meters per second squared.
That's the acceleration of gravity, people.
If you are
at all interested in physics, you will memorize that and use it all the time.
Yep. So he rapidly increased to that speed.
Yeah. His top speed is estimated, because at the time of the recording of this podcast, we do not have the final information, but his top speed was estimated at 833.9 miles per hour, or 1,342.8 kilometers per hour.
Mach 1.24.
Yeah, so Mach being the speed of sound. He had broken the sound barrier. The first human to do so unaided by any sort of vehicle.
Yes. And that's another interesting point, that the interview with the scientist that I had watched said that the speed of sound is a little different at that altitude too.
Right. Sound travels, you know, the speed of sound is dependent upon the medium through which it's traveling.
Mm-hmm.
Sound will travel at a different rate of speed depending on if you are in, it'll travel at a different rate of speed from sea level to 120,000 feet. It travels at a different rate if it's through water or through a solid. So, it's one of the, and in fact, we should, might as well, this is a little bit of a tangent, but light's the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Light travels at, you've heard of the speed of light being a constant. That's
right.
True, but that's talking about the speed of light in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
The speed of light will change depending on what it's traveling through. Now, most of the time for us as human beings, that change is imperceptible to mm-hmm. us without incredibly sensitive measuring equipment. So to us, it's, going at the speed of light or just a hair under the speed of light is mm-hmm. effectively the same thing for us.
Yeah. And I've tried to observe that myself at my home, but I keep getting dust in my eye every time I open that little bag. And it doesn't seem like there's any light in there at all, but it may be the dust. I can't tell.
Oh, right. Inside your vacuum.
Yes.
I got you now. So you should go with a Dyson that's the bagless.
It's clear.
Yeah.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
But yeah, it's funny because when you get the idea of somebody jumping out of an airplane, you're doing a traditional skydive. Most of us have a pretty good idea of what that quote unquote looks like. You stand in the door, you jump out of the plane, and you instantly put out your arms and legs and you just sort of glide until you feel like it's time to open your chute. Then you pull it and go. Well, Felix wasn't as graceful, but it wasn't his fault.
Yeah.
See, as it turns out, that whole atmosphere being thinner thing kind of affects the way you fall at that height.
He couldn't use air resistance to help orient himself, because that's one thing. Experienced skydivers can do all sorts of really cool maneuvers while they're diving, and it's all due to the whole air resistance and being able to use their bodies to angle in certain ways. Either they can do try to resist or change their wind resistance, like reduce it to a point where they're falling very, very, very fast.
Yes.
Or they can try to increase their wind resistance by increasing the surface area as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. They can do somersaults and other kinds of tricks.
But at that altitude, there wasn't enough air, not enough atmosphere to be able to do that. So there wasn't that level of control. And so Felix did start spinning. And if you watch the video, that also was terrifying, because you could see him spinning around and around. And you're like, okay, I sure hope he's able to maintain consciousness, not black out. Because Kittinger said, he blacked out during his fall.
Yeah.
Because of a similar issue. And that's why the drogue chute was so important. It was not the 102,000 foot jump, but the previous one that Kittinger did, mm-hmm. where he blacked out. And so that's why the drogue chute was so important for him in his highest jump.
Yeah.
Well, you could see that spinning happening. But then once he did start hitting the next levels, where the atmosphere was starting to increase in density, he was able to orient himself into a traditional skydive position.
The delta position.
Yeah.
I've heard it called.
And is that what it's called? That's interesting. I've never gone skydiving, so I know very little about it. Although, internet, this is just between me and you. Do not tell my wife, because she would flip out. But I am planning on doing a skydiving jump possibly during CES 2013.
You are not.
I am.
Really?
Yeah, me and Ayaz Akhtar of This Week in Tech are thinking about doing some skydiving during CES 2013.
Are you going to parachute into the show
into
hall?
The Las Vegas Convention Center? Doubtful. It'll be much further out into the desert. But don't tell my wife, because she would flip out. Okay? Pinky swear.
Yeah.
Okay. So anyway, he assumed that position, and then that was the point where I said, oh, good. Well, then he's clearly conscious, and he's aware of what's going on, and he's able to respond. He deployed his chute at the appropriate time, and that was a big – that got a big cheer from mm-hmm. ground control. And did you watch any of the video of his landing?
Oh yeah.
It was a perfect landing.
Absolutely.
It was like he just stepped off a step.
Yeah.
Like it wasn't like he just came from 128,000 feet. It was like he had just walked down a set of stairs.
Yeah. I would have looked like a sack of potatoes from a 20 foot jump.
I would have been dragged. I would have been dragged at least another few hundred meters. I'm sure.
He's an accomplished jumper. He's
yes.
an accomplished base jumper. Which is, jumping off of, ironically enough, it's, lower altitudes, bridges and all sorts of other different physical features. So he's this is, well, you wouldn't try this at home anyway, but yeah. I mean, this is not something from that an inexperienced person did. He's clearly a well accomplished jumper, and he, yeah, it was an absolutely perfect landing. And then he got, as soon as he came to a stop, he went down on his knees and put his hands up in the air like, that was pretty awesome.
Yeah,
it was.
I had made the comment of, if I had done that, I would have made the decision, I am never leaving the ground again. From now on, people bring stuff to me.
Yeah.
I did my part.
It's like, I'm not going back over the ocean. You bring that continent
right.
here.
I want to go to London. Bring London here.
No, it was an absolutely amazing, amazing feat. And it does have a lot of, importance. You might not necessarily believe that.
Right. You might think of it as simply some sort of stunt. Yeah. But it, going beyond that, I mean, there are, first of all, this kind of is a proof of concept of something that NASA was talking about in the 60s when they were thinking about, if there were a problem with a spacecraft, would it be possible for astronauts to space dive back to Earth? Would there be any way they could do that? Or is that just outside the realm of our abilities? And they theorized that it would be possible, but they were never able to test it.
Mm-hmm.
Kittinger's jumps were kind of related to that. And a lot of the data that they collected during this jump, there was stuff that they could put toward developing more safety features for astronauts as well as space tourists, because whoever thought that would become a thing, but now it is, you know?
Well, and there, I saw some people talking about the space shuttle program and, of course the two famous disasters.
Right.
One of the people that has been working on this is, the husband of one of the people who perished in the Columbia accident. Mm. They were too high to have done something like this. They were too far out from the planet when the accident happened, and they were moving way too fast. Something like Mach 17, I think I remember.
Right.
Reading it was Dr. Jonathan Clark, who was a former NASA flight surgeon. His wife Laurel died in that accident. So, he was involved in the process of going through the safety procedures here. He's dedicated his life to working on better safety in space. And, as far as the Challenger incident, well, it's sort of unclear whether they would have been able to get out or not. Of course, some of the procedures they developed for the space shuttle were after that, as a result of that accident. So, in the future, depending on the different kinds of missions that are undertaken, either by NASA or another government space agency or by private enterprise, I think that this information could prove useful, in an emergency or, perhaps as a form of space tourism. I don't know.
Well, and just learning what the effects are of these, the things that Felix experienced during this whole jump. I mean, everything from breaking the sound barrier, that no one was really sure what would happen to a person. And in fact, to be fair, as of the recording of this podcast, we cannot be certain that he did break that barrier because the final numbers haven't come in. He had did you see how he would know if he broke the sound barrier?
Mm-mm.
So he has a chest plate, had a chest plate on his suit that contained a lot of different sensors, telemetry, information, GPS, all this kind of stuff. If the sensors detected that the suit had exceeded the speed of sound, it would send a ringtone to his helmet.
Ha.
But he said he was concentrating so hard on what was going on that he totally didn't notice anything. So it may have gone off or it may not have gone off, and he doesn't know, because he was, at that point, I'm kind of just really paying attention to what's going on, especially once, he came out of that spin.
Yeah.
So
I'm flying here.
Yeah. I got, hey lady, I'm flying here. Yeah. There are a lot of things that this could help with, including designing new types of spacesuits that are effective and are not as, you know, we can always make advances in that realm. We don't want it to be so clunky that you can't maneuver around within the confines of a space vehicle.
Yeah.
But it still has to have the adequate levels of protection necessary to maintain the health and safety of our astronauts.
Yeah.
So that's an important thing to keep in mind too. Now, mm-hmm. granted, I don't think most of our space suits will necessarily have sponsor logos on them, but
or maybe they will.
Maybe they will. I was disappointed that the spacesuit didn't have wings.
Well, it was interesting too to compare, and you know, I'm going in my head here, looking at the suits that they wore in NASA launches from the 1960s and 70s, were so much bulkier than this. Well, I mean, they were intended for different purposes, but I imagine the equipment in this newer suit was far more advanced than what Kittinger wore.
Yeah.
On his jumps, and you know, with the technology advances, you know, it's funny that in a way they resemble more what Hollywood suggests for, you know, space fighter pilots than from what the astronauts, the actual astronauts from our own planet wore back in the days when that was so common.
I look forward to the day when we have space suits for space jumps that are like the ones in the documentary Star Trek.
Yeah.
Not the original motion picture Star Trek, but the J.J. Abrams documentary Star Trek.
Yeah.
The J.J. Abrams documentary Star Trek : The Lens Flare.
It caught me off guard.
So, yeah, do you have anything else you wanted to talk about this jump in particular? Mm-hmm. It was a really neat thing to watch live, and Twitter was going bonkers as this was happening. I saw so many people I know tweeting about this, and it just seemed like there was an overall sense of excitement I was not the only terrified person on Earth watching this.
No.
And you can watch the entire presentation as well. It's up online, so you can go and watch, or you can watch segments of it if you don't have, you know, 2.5 hours to burn. But it's definitely something amazing. It's one of those moments in human achievement where you think, wow, it never would have occurred to me that this is something that anyone would want to do. And if they wanted to do it, I can't imagine it being possible. And yet both of those things happened.
Yep. It was an amazing event, and I'm glad it ended so well.
Yes, definitely.
Picture perfect.
Yep. It was so many different things could have gone wrong. I'm glad a lot of really smart people worked on this to make sure it went off without any major glitches.
Yeah.
So my hat is off to you and all of the team that was responsible for this. It's pretty phenomenal. So Felix, go put up your feet, relax. You know, maybe slow down a little bit for a while, you know? You know, stop and smell the roses. Don't. And not at 120,000 feet.
Keep your feet on the ground and keep reaching for the stars.
Right. So, guys, if you have any subjects you think we should cover in future episodes of Tech Stuff, I highly recommend you get in touch with us and let us know, because otherwise, how would we find out? One way you can let us know is by sending us an email. That address is techstuff@discovery.com, or you can always let us know on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle there is TechStuffHSW, and Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, "Somebody's in the house," and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.